See Radio 3.
And closer to the present, there's music from the English royal courts, from Henry VIII to George III in the early music show. That's in just a couple of minutes. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM. We're on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's 1 o'clock. The news now read by Lopa Kotari.
The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for an immediate end to anti-government protests, which have entered their second day. Mr. Erdogan said he would investigate the police's use of water cannon against the demonstrators, but he indicated that the government would press ahead with the redevelopment plans that sparked the demonstrations. The United Nations has reported that more than 1,000 people were killed in violence in Iraq in May, making it the deadliest month since the widespread violence in 2006 and 2007. Analysts say al-Qaeda and Sunni insurgents have been invigorated by the Sunni-led revolt in Syria. A man has appeared before magistrates in Telford, charged with the murder of a 17-year-old girl, Georgia Williams, who went missing on Sunday. Jamie Reynolds, who's 22, was remanded in custody. A man has been arrested in Shrewsbury in connection with the attempted murder of two police officers in a terrorist attack in Belfast on Tuesday. He'll be taken to Northern Ireland for questioning. The far-right British National Party is holding a protest march in central London in response to the murder of drummer Lee Rigby by two suspected Islamist extremists. The Metropolitan Police rerouted the march, which was to have taken place in Woolwich, where the killing occurred 10 days ago. Groups opposed to the BNP are holding counter-demonstrations. The Conservative MP, Zach Goldsmith, has said that voters should be able to replace their MP if they lose serious confidence in them. He was responding to an investigation by the BBC and the Daily Telegraph into the Conservative MP, Patrick Mercer. He's said to have offered a common security pass to a fake lobbying firm, which paid him £4,000 to table parliamentary questions. And the weather, southern England will continue to be dry with sunny spells, with the best of the sunshine in the southwest. Wales and southern Scotland will also be sunny, but there'll be cloud over northern England and northern Scotland. And that's the latest BBC News. The time is 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by Lopa Kotari. Well, time now on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, which today is part of our new month-long celebration of British music, with tomorrow marking the 60th anniversary of the Queen's coronation. Lucy Skeeping takes a look now at the private music of the royal courts from centuries past.
Pastime with good company. I love and shall until I die. What a sensible idea. And if the signature at the top of that song is to be taken seriously, then the author of those lyrics, and probably the composer too, was none other than the monarch whose love life provides television with so much fodder, Henry VIII. Not that Henry really needed to write his own music. As far back as Saxon times, English kings had their own musical entertainers in permanent employment, and some evidently more committed to the role than was good for them. William the Conqueror's minstrel, Taillefer, for instance, is recorded as dying at the Battle of Hastings whilst he was still singing and juggling. By Tudor times, though, royal music was getting much more organised. A distinction was now made between the public musicians, who played loud instruments for ceremonial or state occasions, and those whose job it was to play more intimate music in the king's private chambers or for informal entertainments. And it's their music we're going to be hearing in today's early music show. The number of pieces that survive from the Tudor period is quite small. Much of it wasn't written down or was improvised. But one important source is the so-called Lumley Part Books, compiled in the mid-1500s, which contain some anonymous dances, including these two performed here on viols. A pavan followed by a lively galliard. Fretwork with a pavan and a galliard from the Tudor court. Dancing was an enormously important court activity, and Elizabeth I's enthusiasm for it lasted well into her old age. "I assure you," wrote one courtier, "that 6 or 7 galliards of a morning, besides music and singing, is her ordinary exercise." Like her father, Elizabeth was also an accomplished musician, as much delighted with the art as she is skilful, according to her teacher. One visitor to the palace, an envoy from Mary, Queen of Scots, related hearing her play the virginals. "As I passed by the chamber door, I heard such a good melody as ravished me and drew me within," he wrote, explaining that he then hid behind a tapestry to hear her play excellently well. Undoubtedly the greatest composer of Elizabeth's time was William Byrd, gentleman of the Royal Chapel. He made this setting of an old German melody around the 1580s, and its dedicatee appears to be Elizabeth herself, the Queen's Almain.
Thank you.
David Moroni on the virginals with William Byrd's The Queen's Almain. The accession of James I from Scotland had an important effect on the musical life of the court. At least his children did, because, unlike their father, all three of them were musical. And as they grew up, each began to employ a sizeable number of musicians in their separate households. The two princes, Henry and Charles, were taught to play the viol in the usual consort fashion. But the most important innovation in this period was the introduction of the violin into mixed or broken consorts in music by Corporario, Lupo, Ferrabosco and Orlando Gibbons, whose three-part fantasia we're going to hear in this next set. The two princes also enlarged their father's ensemble to make a substantial violin band, perhaps the first of its kind in Europe. And we'll hear just how this fledgling string orchestra sounded in the two dance pieces that follow. The Prince's Almain and The Prince's Coranto, both by Robert Johnson. And to start the set, we heard Fantasia by Orlando Gibbons. The performers were the Parley of Instruments, directed by Peter Holman. When Prince Charles became Charles I in 1625, for his Master of the King's Music, he appointed the London-born Nicholas Lanier. Lanier's great knowledge of art also meant that in the same year he was dispatched to Italy to purchase paintings for the royal collection. And it was probably during this trip that he heard some of the Italian styles that he was to incorporate into his own compositions for the English court. As a notable singer and lutenist, Lanier almost certainly accompanied himself, and we might imagine him performing this next song to a select audience at the palace, impressing them with its recitativo style, which has something of the drama of the Italian opera.
That I can strain out of my empty lovesick brain cannot allay my scorching pain. Fire, fire, lo, here I burn in such desire that all the tears that I can strain empty lovesick brain cannot allay my scorching pain. Come, humber Trent and silver Thames, dread ocean haste with all thy streams, and if you cannot both me and my desire. Come, humber Trent and silver Thames, dread ocean haste with all thy streams, and if you cannot quench my fire, or drown both me and my desire. Fire, fire, there is no hell to my desire. See all the rivers backward fly, and the ocean doth his aid deny, for fear thy heat should drink them dry. Backward fly, and the ocean doth his aid deny, for fear my feet should drink them dry. Come, heavenly showers, then pouring down, come you that once the then you spared, but now save all that else might burn and with me fall. Come, heavenly showers, then pouring down, come you that once the world
Nicholas Lanier's Fire, Fire, Paul Agnew with Christopher Wilson on the theorbo. You're listening to the Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, here on BBC Radio 3. And we're in the middle of a whistle-stop tour of the private music of the English court. And this is a good place to take a quick breather because we've reached the Civil War period when it all started to go horribly wrong, not only for the royals, but for the musicians they employed who were forced to go into exile. But not all of them did. In fact, quite a few joined in the fighting. And one composer who remained loyal to his king right to the end was William Laws. In 1642, amid the mounting tensions, Laws promptly enlisted into the army, on the proviso that he would be kept out of danger. But during the siege of Chester, he was, it was said, betrayed by his own adventurousness. Watching the action from a hilltop, he rode down to get a better view and was shot in the head by a rebel sniper. Charles mourned him like anything, calling his favourite composer the father of music.
Thank you.
the Purcell Quartet with movements from William Law's Royal Consort Suite No. 3. Oh, and just to remind you, you can hear this programme again on the BBC iPlayer, and a download version is also available from the Radio 3 website. So after 1660, following his exile in France, the newly restored Charles II soon began to make changes to his musical household in order to reflect his obsession with all things French. His dislike of old-fashioned counterpoint meant he did away with the small mixed ensembles, and in their place, on the basis of anything Louis XIV could do, he could do better, he enlarged the Royal Violin Band to emulate the one he'd seen at the French court. He called it the 24 Violins, and a section of it, led by the composer John Bannister, was granted access to the Privy Chamber to provide musical entertainment. And when the Queen, Catherine of Braganza, went to Bath to take the waters, they all came too. Part of John Bannister's The Music at the Bath, the Parley of Instruments directed by Peter Holman. Well, a leap in time now to the glorious Revolution and the court of William and Mary, who arrived on England's shores as joint rulers in 1689. Henry Purcell was very much involved in court life. As organist at Westminster Abbey and at the Chapel Royal, he was regularly called upon to compose music for special occasions, such as royal marriages and birthdays. And we hear now part of his birthday ode for Queen Mary for the year 1690, her 28th birthday, if my maths is correct. Thank you. the King's consort with the first part of Purcell's 1690 birthday ode for Queen Mary, as it probably sounded, small scale. King William may not be particularly interested in music, but surely even he must have been stirred by such a majestic sound. Mary, on the other hand, seems to have been rather partial to popular tunes, a particular favourite being the old country dance and ballad known as Cold and Raw. The story goes that one day, whilst Purcell was in attendance at the harpsichord, she asked to hear it, and later, to please her, he incorporated the little melody into the bass line of her next birthday ode, Love's Goddess Shore. We'll hear a little of the original ballad now, followed by Purcell's setting, where, as you'll hear, it's stated loud and clear before the soprano begins.
Cold and raw the north did blow, bleak in the morning early. All the trees were hid in snow, danged by winter yearly. When come riding over the now, I met with a farmer's daughter. Rosy cheeks and bonny brow, good faith made my mouth to water. Down I veiled my bonnet low, meaning to show my breeding. She returned a graceful bow, her visage far exceeding. I asked her where she went so soon, and longed to begin a parley. She told me unto the next market town, a purpose to sell her
Gillian Fisher with the King's consort in May Her Blessed Example, part of Purcell's birthday ode for Queen Mary. And before that, Paul Elliott and the Broadside Band gave us a snatch of the traditional ballad tune Cold and Raw. Well, we reached the 18th century and an era that's had a rather bad press. Historians have seen the death of Purcell in 1695 and Handel's arrival in London 15 years later as symbols of the decline of homegrown music in favour of foreign domination. And you could say they have a point, because certainly England attracted hundreds of immigrant musicians throughout this century. One was the virtuoso violinist and composer Francesco Gimignani, who arrived in 1714. Italian music was all the rage in London, and he soon found himself supported by the aristocracy and leading figures at the royal court. Within a year came an invitation to perform for the king himself, George I. We don't know what he played, but it must have been some concert, since none other than Handel was at the keyboard. Perhaps it was this.
Thank you.
Geminiani's Violin Sonata in E Minor, Opus 1, No. 3, performed by Elizabeth Volfish on violin, with Richard Boothby on cello and harpsichordist Robert Woolley. In 1762, Bach's youngest son, Johann Christian, joined the talented throng of foreign musicians at the English court. The London Bach, as he was later dubbed, soon became a valued member of Queen Charlotte's personal chamber band. In the evenings, he and the king got together on the flute and harpsichord, and according to the memoirs of a Mrs. Papendieck, assistant keeper of the royal wardrobe, no less, Bach was evidently quick-witted and full of charm. She relates how he and his friend Arbel used to take it in turns to perform for the royal dinner parties, but on one occasion Bach totally forgot it was his turn. So after dinner, she recalled, he sat down and wrote an enchanting first movement of a quintet in three flats. He sent for two copyists who wrote down the parts from the score over his shoulders while he wrote the melody. The quintet is ranked among the best of his compositions, wrote Mrs. Papendieck, clearly impressed. But we'll end today with one of his keyboard sonatas. And who knows, perhaps Queen Charlotte played it herself.
first movement of the Keyboard Sonata Opus 5, number 1 by Queen Charlotte's music master Johann Christian Bach, performed there by Sophie Yates, and ending the early music show's showcase of the private music of the English royal courts from Henry VIII to George III. The presenter was Lucy Skeeping, and there'll be more royal music in tomorrow's early music show when Radio 3's celebration of British music continues with an exploration of music at the court of Mary Queen of Scots. That's at the same time tomorrow lunchtime, just after the 1 o'clock news.
Celebrating British music this June on BBC Radio 3. And the opening night of the 2013 Aldborough Festival, with a masterpiece by the festival's founder, Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes. A concert performance of Peter Grimes, conducted by leading Britten interpreter Stuart Bedford. Radio 3 live in concert from Aldborough, Friday night at 7:15 on BBC Radio 3.
And there's more Benjamin Britten in Monday's Radio 3 Live in Concert. Ilan Volkov conducts the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra in a Britten centenary concert from Amsterdam, the concert including music by Britten's teacher Frank Bridge, what a good many believe to be his masterpiece, Enter Spring. And that's followed on in the second half by Britten's own Spring Symphony. The concert comes direct from the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, and it starts here on Radio 3 at 7:15 on Monday evening. Back to this Saturday afternoon, it's 2 o'clock, and time now for the Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert, a second chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast from Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall for this live lunchtime concert of music for string quartet by Dvorak and Beethoven. The players are the members of the Pacifica Quartet, which came together in 1994 and began winning major prizes immediately. In 2006, the quartet was awarded the prestigious Avery Fisher Career Grant, only the second chamber ensemble to be so honoured in the long history of this award. Since last year, violinists Simin Ganatra and Sigurbjörn Bernhardsson, violist Masumi Per Rostad and cellist Brandon Vamos have been quartet in residence at the University of Indiana. But they also travel a great deal and were here at Wigmore Hall in the spring of 2012 playing Shostakovich. The first piece in today's recital began life as a song cycle. The 18 songs of Dvorak's Cypresses were written in July 1865, when the composer was 23 and in the grip of a torrent of creativity inspired by his pangs of unrequited love for Josefina Chermakova. The songs were among his first attempts at word setting, and he admitted that some of them were a little clumsy. But like Josefina herself, they stayed in his heart, and over the years, he reworked many of them to greater effect. In 1887, Dvorak arranged a dozen Cypresses for string quartet, and we're going to hear three of them now, numbers 2, 3, and 11 of the set. They're every bit as expressive instrumentally as they were in song form, aided by the retention of the original titles. Death reigns in many a human breast, when thy sweet glances on me fall, and finally, nature lies peaceful in slumber and dream. And now we welcome to the Wigmore Hall platform the Pacifica Quartet to begin their recital with these three Cypresses by Dvorak.
Thank you.